The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Okay, I'm attached. Good evening again, and Happy New Year. Well, in Japan, where I grew up, New Year's is the biggest and most auspicious holiday. I mean, it's not even a holiday. It's a very sacred time. And New Year's Eve means the kind of metaphoric end of everything. People clean up their homes thoroughly, reflect on the passing year, bring closure to things, maybe relationships, and make a sacred space for that which is new and unknown. And at midnight, the Buddhist temples everywhere in Japan ring that giant outdoor gong that goes gong 108 times to chase the evil away, or 108 roots of suffering, human suffering. So that is to purify the mind, you know, chasing away evils, cleaning the house. It's really emptying and making space. And when the New Year sun arises, which is a very holy and sacred moment, everything begins anew. So everything you do that day, especially the first day of the year, actually, New Year's festival goes on for 7 days, is considered auspiciously new. So every event that happens that day has an adjective, new something or first something, and something that you start or something that new set up a course for what will follow during the rest of the year. For instance, when you have the dream, when you wake up from the dream of the first year, that's called the first dream, and you're supposed to really reflect on the meaning, and some people believe it really tells you about the rest of the year. When Mark asked me to sub for him, I don't think he had any idea that giving a first Dharma talk on the first Sunday night of the new year, of the new decade, depending on how you count, would be such an intimidating idea, at least for the Japanese part of me. And luckily, I'm not in Japan, and hopefully none of you will predict how the rest of the year of Common Ground will go based on my little humble talk tonight. But there's something really refreshing and useful about the tradition of making a big deal out of a radical renewal and to follow through for the year and to let that become a path. So tonight I want to share some of my thoughts and practices related to that. And the title I just made up is called A Path is Made by Walking. Have you noticed how hard it is to actually start something new and stick with it, learn something you never learned before, and follow through? Have you ever noticed how hard it is to change old habits, those habits that no longer serve your well-being? How hard is it to change? Have you noticed even how we think about changing old habits itself becomes a habit? A habitual approach to habit is the opposite of radical renewal. It keeps up looping around the same familiar pathways that leads to stagnation. The neuroscience has made a couple of significant discoveries that are relevant to our lives and to our practices, I think, both formal practice and off the cushion. The Canadian behavioral psychologist Donald proposed that when two neurons fire at the same time repeatedly, chemical change occur in both, so that the two tends to connect more strongly. And his concept was neatly summarized by neuroscientist Carlos Schatz and has become a popular axiom: neurons that fire together wire together. How many of you heard that? So what this means in practical terms is that each time you repeat a particular thought or action, the connection between a set of brain cells or neurons is strengthened and kind of become bundled together. At least, I think bundle is a metaphor. And the other major and more recent discovery is the idea of neuroplasticity. And it refers to the ability of the brain to change as a result of one's experience, that the brain is plastic and malleable. Until recently, the belief among scientists had been that the brain does not change after the critical periods of infancy. What a sad thought. And this idea of neuroplasticity, you know, it's possible to keep on changing. Of course, it's wonderful. Cells that are used stay strong and ready to fire more, and lack of use make any cell atrophy, whether it is a muscle cell or a neuron. I think the Buddha had already known, among many other things, the idea of neuroplasticity 2,500 years ago. And modern neuroscience, it's just catching up with the Buddha. Even the axiom of neurons that fire together, wire together, reflects a kind of a mechanistic notion. Actually, neurons are not like wires. They're living cells, and like all living things, they change constantly and adapt in constant relationship with their environment. So I would like to offer my metaphor of how change happens. Let's say we want to go to the beautiful ocean we heard about, and it's way yonder where we can't see. Let's say I'm facing a prairie of tall grass higher than me. And if I want to go somewhere, I have to start somewhere in the grass. I might look around and see some opening or parting of the grass. I might even find a suggestion of a footpath, or I stumble into it. So that's where I might walk without really knowing where I'm going. And just because it was there, I walk it. And this path keeps bringing me right back to where I started. And I do want to go somewhere, so I walk on the path again, because it's there. And it brings me back to where I started, and I walk it again, because it is there. And by the time I walk it the 10th time, it has become a well-trodden path, because it's there. It's a well-trodden path, so I don't have to part the grass anymore. So I'm back at where I started for the 100th time, and I finally get it that I forgot to look at the North Star and the ocean I wanted to reach. In front of me is the path I walked so many times, inviting me to yet do another walk again. And by now it has become a deep groove, and it's harder to get off it. But I finally remember to look up. The North Star said, "No, it's not that one, it's that way." A bunch of very tall grass all around me, and I'm tired now. You know, I walked a lot. I want to just go easy, familiar way, but I need to make my first step in the wilderness without being certain if I will arrive. making our first step in the wilderness is hard. Often we think of the second or third or the tenth step without actually committing to the first step. It takes time to realize that the very thinking is part of the old habit. We have an old habit of thinking about changing the old habit, don't you know? That's why old habits never change. We confuse ourselves by the promising thought of making a change. To actually commit to the act of stepping forward takes courage and also some faith. When we realize that we have been walking in circles, we stop. That's the first thing to do. And we need to look around. It calls for the act of acknowledging exactly where we are in the season of our existence, to look at possibilities as well as the ways we sabotage ourselves. So we step forward towards the thick grass that way. And with that action, our brain registers something novel, and a new neural connection is created. As we make the second step, we begin to make a thin trace of parted grass behind us, and more neural connections form. What is needed is to both look down on the ground to make sure it is firm and that there are no snake or scorpions to step on, but also to look up in the sky to remember where our heart really wants to reach. This way, a new path is being created, step by step. In the meantime, the unused loop of the habit path will eventually be covered over and will disappear in its own time. That's how we get rid of our old habit. My husband and I, have a new dog, Luna, and just so you can imagine, she is a cutest yellow lab mix. Lab, but with a curly tail. And I take her for an off-leash walk in the hilly woods nearby our house every morning. And when the big blizzard hit about 3 weeks ago, the woods were completely covered by 1 to 2 feet of snow. And I ventured into the hill in my long boots with grippers and everything on, but it took such an effort and concentration to just make one step in the knee-deep snow. Pulling up a foot, stepping and sinking deeply into the snow, pulling up, repeating all over again. When I finally got up to the ridge at the halfway point, I was out of breath and really demoralized. This was not the spacious, meditative walk that I was used to. Oh my! Despondent, I stopped to turn back to walk back in my own deep footsteps. Well, I even considered taking a shortcut through the city streets. But that means I have to give up the ease and freedom of no leash. And this dog pulls hard. So the glistening morning woods and fields with soft, fresh snow were so quiet, and it was so pristine. Yet it was so full of presence. How could I give it up? But I'm stuck in a knee-deep snow without a trail. I calmed down, looked over the ledge into the wide expanse of the marsh. Looking up, the sun was turning the top of the tree branches into burnt ochre against the blue sky. It was really beautiful. And I heard the voice that says, "Create a path by walking." The night before that, we watched a NOVA program on fractals. I thought about the beautiful geometric fractal shapes, and then our brains and trees, how a forest of broccoli and neurons and tree branches grow by creating a reduced size copy of the whole, reaching out and up in ever smaller scale. I also thought about meditation practice, how much effort and concentration it takes sometimes to just keep on returning to this one breath. A path is made by walking. In my brain, in these woods, and perhaps in this spiritual journey. So I decided to walk on in the snow, footstep by footstep, creating a trail where there was none, and I promised myself that I'm going to come back here every day until a path was made by my walking. When we create a path by walking, many other lessons follow. For one, we have to slow down and look around before we make the next step. Once I lost my balance and fell completely over on my back. And then I lay there, looking. And it was just so beautiful that there was a blue sky and the clouds were languidly moving and it was really quiet. And, oh, if I didn't fall, you know, I wouldn't have that new way of looking at the world. I just wanted to be there forever. Of course, I got cold. But again, I want to say, by losing balance and falling, I got to have a whole new way of looking at the world. How often do I forget that the big sky is always there, no matter how lost I am in what's in front of me? How often do we get lost in the contents of the conditioned mind and forget that the unconditioned is always there? Another path I am making, it's in my interior terrain through an encounter with death. Making a path in the snow is easy compared to this. The path making in my interior has felt more like fumbling around in a moonless ancient forest, or maybe a jungle with beasts with red eyes and poison snakes and vines, and there even might be monsters and ghouls hiding. Some of you know that my husband was diagnosed with stage 4 pancreatic cancer some months ago. Even with modern medicine, the disease is considered to be usually fatal. The 1-year survival rate for this disease at this stage is 15%. And the overall survival rate is less than 5% in 5 years. How do I make sense of such numbers in the midst of aliveness, of this life that I have been sharing with him for nearly 3 decades? I have done a number of death and dying practices as part of my 2-year-long training in Satipatthana training, including visualizing in detail my own death, that of my beloved, and meditation on the contemplation of the decomposition of the body. But to face the real and possibly imminent death of my beloved has brought my awareness to its edge. What is it like to really disappear from this earth? Or do we disappear? How is physical death different from the death of our ego self? Is there a way to prepare for these deaths? This is no longer a practice in my imagination, but a dive into the unknown, perhaps unknowable. Death is a difficult topic to talk about. It is a taboo in our culture. Not only that, I am still that one who is fumbling around in the dark. Yet every spiritual tradition talks of the necessity to apprentice with death and dying. How can we truly reflect and integrate Buddha's teaching on suffering, impermanence, and not self without leaning into this abyss? How do I live my life or die my death with my whole being, with equanimity and compassion for myself and for others? How can I affirm my wholeness and well-being no matter what happens, no matter what arises in the mind? So I made an intention to consciously explore this darkness for 3 months period, starting from the September equinox to this solstice, the season of darkness and the long nights. It helped to remember the time we did a night dive long ago in the Caribbean. You know, it's really an experience to be on a dark night, in a dark boat, looking into the black ocean, and you just dive in upside down, and then you just kind of float, and then you just, it's like being in a space. You don't know what's top or what's bottom. But once your eyes get used to it, as you go lower part, the dark seas actually, it's not black. It was full of bioluminescent little creatures, and it was beautiful. Even though it was disorienting, there was a feeling of being held by the buoyancy of the dark, warm water. The dark was not what I thought it to be. The poet David White said, "Death is a powerful inverse light that can actually bring out truth of our existence." He said in one of his poems, "Time to go into the dark where the night has eyes to recognize its own. There you can be sure you are not beyond love." A voice said, "Don't be afraid of the dark." With some urgency, my husband and I returned to the dog-eared pages of Healing into Life and Death by Stephen Levine. To paraphrase Levine, our fear of death is the other side of the coin of our fear of life. When we think of dying, we think of losing something called me. We wish to protect this thing at all cost, though we have very little direct experience of what this really refers to. The more we have invested in protecting this me, the more we have to lose and less we are open to investigating deeper perception of what dies, of what really exists. And he goes on to say, until we have nothing to hide, we cannot be free. If we consider the contents of the mind as the enemy, then we become frightened, or we think there's something wrong with us. We need to recognize the mind as just the result of previous conditioning. It is nothing special, nothing bad or good. We must begin to cultivate the compassion that allows the moment to be as it is, in the clear light of awareness, without the least postponement of the truth. We must begin to cultivate the compassion that allows the moment to be as it is, in the clear light of awareness, without the postponement of the truth. For 10 years I cared for my mother with Alzheimer's. At her death 3 years ago, I asked these same questions. Where did she go? What happened to the mother's love for the child? Where do I direct my love for her now that she's gone? These questions of love captivated me then and again now as I stand at the edge of the cliff. One of the many teachings of the death has been that it urgently and incessantly asks what is our heart's true priority. And it has to be the priority in the now, as we stop thinking of our future as real. What really matters to this heart right now? And that becomes a call to name our truth. And that makes more and more clear how much of what we thought to be the truth was really the self-centered expectations, preconceptions, driven by the need to survive. So much of what we think of as real is but the mere construction of the conditioned mind. So much of what we think as real is but the mere construction of the mind, the conditioned mind. What is real then? Is love real? If love is out of self-survival, then it too is subject to condition. What can I trust? If the nature of the conditioned mind is an ever-changing flow of impermanence, what can we take refuge in? Slowly the veil has been lifting, and as if through a misty dawn, I began to perceive something about what dies and what does not die. The well-known German mystic, Meister Eckhart, was asked once where we go when we die. And he said, nowhere. How do we understand that? Ram Dass was asked, what do you think of death? What do you think death is? By his mother as she lay dying. He answered, well, I don't know. But when I look at you, it's like I see somebody I love, a very dear friend, inside a building that's burning. I see the building being destroyed. But somehow, as you and I talk, you and I are still here. And I have the suspicion that even though the body is being consumed by this illness, not much is going to happen. We stay there in the silence together, just holding hands for many hours. The poet and teacher, I read a lot his writing, David White, says that death is something we are never to understand. But perhaps death is something we are asked to experience each moment. Don't we die each moment in the gap between the becoming of the self? Inhaling a breath, it comes to an end. It's gone forever. And then we exhale, and it too is gone. That's why we pay attention to this breath right now, not the last and not the next. A whole universe is in this half a breath. The last and the next are mere thoughts of breath. Another gift in facing death, though sometimes, well, maybe often, it has felt like a curse, is how it makes us feel so naked and vulnerable. As we were born, we die without any control whatsoever about what happens to our body. We never know when and how we die. And sometimes when you're really sick, you really begin to lose a lot of control over the functions of your body. And you need a lot of humility and courage to just deal with that. It compels us to be honest and humble. Perhaps even innocent like a baby. There really is nowhere to hide. Accepting this inevitable vulnerability gives us a kind of a strange courage to stand tall and naked on the edge. One teacher said, "The mind creates the abyss, and the heart crosses it. Love is the bridge." The mind creates the abyss, and the heart crosses it. Love is the bridge. Again, Stephen Levine. When the mind is clear, we can see all the way to the heart, recognizing how all that seems so solid is actually in constant change. We watch the process like a complete beginner. As resistance melts and less obstructs our clear passage inward, we go beyond our suffering, crossing the chasm between the unhealed and the ever uninjured. Crossing the chasm between the unhealed and the ever uninjured, that which has always been whole. Stephen Levine said, "Love is the last element of form which takes us to the formless." And in this sense, love is not the emotion as we often think about. It is the sense of the inherent connection between these two, the unconditioned and the conditioned, that goes beyond duality to the oneness of being. It's not a state of mind, but rather it's a state of our underlying suchness. So my insight has been that love too is impersonal in the sense that it does not emerge out of my self-concept. My self is not the source of love. Love too is like the open sky above. It's always there. we may live and express it through our personality in each of our unique forms. But love does not belong to us. We belong to it. My mother's love become the love of the world mother for the world child. Love is not personal. Life is not personal. Even death is not personal. None of them is about me, but I am about it. So, the greatest and in some ways the most surprising gift from the teaching of death, and I hope I will be learning, so it's teaching of learning so far, it has been about love. Really surprised. When we are so naked and afraid, it is love that holds us steady with a felt sense of belonging to something unfathomably infinite and timeless. That is the true nature of who we are. As my root teacher, Matt Flickstein, once said many years ago, and I didn't understand it for many, many years, he said, "You are who you have always been looking for." I'm still wandering in the forest, but the light is dawning. There were no real ghouls except for what the mind created. And I'm still making a path. Who knows what terrain I will be in 6 months from now? Who knows if I still have this body and these words to report back to you? Well, in the meantime, I need to get back to my woods, both inner and outer. And each of us need to get back to the task of path making, one step, one breath at a time. So, in closing, I want to offer a poem as a little lamplight or a little crinkled map to guide our way in the wilderness of our wandering and our seemingly ordinary everyday life. And many of you may know this poem is called Hokusai Says. Who knows who Hokusai is? One? Two? Three? Oh my! Okay, who has seen this picture of big wave and the Mount Fuji behind it and the boat? Who has seen that? Right? Okay, so that woodblock is made by Hokusai, and Hokusai is a really well-known 19th century Japanese artist and a woodblock artist. And part of the reason I thought about Hokusai was in watching the Fractals show on Nova. They showed his painting of his wave, which and he made those little tiny splashes, and each little splash is a replicate, tiny replicate of the big splash, and he just made it smaller and smaller. And he was a master at paying attention and observing. So this poem, a little gift, a little map, a little lamp, a candle. And it's written by Roger Keats, so it's not written by Hokusai. This is Roger Keats' poem about Hokusai. Hokusai says, look carefully. Look carefully. He says, keep looking. Stay curious. He says, there is no end to seeing. He says, look forward to getting old. He says, keep changing. You just get more who you really are. He says, get stuck. And I would add, fall down. Accept it. Repeat yourself as long as it's interesting. He says, keep doing what you love. Keep doing what you love. He says, keep praying. He says that every one of us is a child. Every one of us is ancient. Every one of us has a body. He says that every one of us is frightened. He says that every one of us has to find a way to live with fear. He says everything is alive. Everything is alive. Shells, buildings, people, fish, mountains, trees. Wood is alive. Water is alive. Everything has its own life. And everything lives inside us. He says, live with the world inside you. Live with the world inside you. He says, it doesn't matter if you draw or write books. It doesn't matter if you saw wood or catch fish. It doesn't matter if you sit at home and stare at the ants on your veranda or the shadows of the trees and grasses in your garden. It matters that you care. It matters that you feel. It matters that you notice. It matters that life lives through you. It matters that life lives through you. Contentment is life living through you. Joy is life living through you. Satisfaction and strength is life living through you. Peace is life living through you. He says, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Look. Feel. Let life take you by the hand. Let life live through you. Let life live through you. So, we have some time for questions, comments, discussions. K-E-Y-E-S.
There's a poem that has lived through me a lot.
Yes, it's ours. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, that's beautiful. Can you repeat it once again?
It's a Rumi poem. If I see you, if I really see you, I will laugh out loud, fall silent, or explode into a thousand pieces. And if I don't, I forgot that part. If I don't, I'll be caught in the cement stone of my own person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know that one. Were you able to hear? Can you hear over there? Thank you. You know, it sucks that we don't learn unless we fall and make mistakes. Did we notice that? So, you know, when we fall, we say, thank you for this opportunity. Well, this silence feels very rich to me. So let's just sit together for a few minutes, okay? Let's do merit. May our practice benefit our family, our teachers, our neighbors, our friends, all people everywhere. May we all be friends to our own body and be kind to it. May we be at ease. May we be safe and protected. May all beings be free from suffering.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.